take a look at a topic that should affect each and every one of us. It's something that I'm sure sooner or later, or maybe sometime in the past, we've been in a situation that we've wondered whether or not we handled it correctly. Were we silent when we shouldn't have been silent? Were we silent because we didn't want to contribute to any more trouble? Maybe many of us, from the stands that we've taken in the past, we've had trouble. And do you think, boy, I just don't want any more of that, and so I'll just be quiet this time? Well, this is actually a national phenomenon. It's called the bystander syndrome. And it goes back to an old case study back in 1961, originally called the Genovese syndrome. It was an injury, an assault case, where a woman was stabbed up, I believe it was in Brooklyn. This is a long time ago, the year I was born, actually, that became a case study in psychology on how people tend to react when nobody wants to get involved. So a group of bystanders were standing around, a woman was stabbed. And I was thinking about this and was thinking about how many times I've seen news clips now. Just over and over, it's like every two or three weeks there's one of these attacks, and there'll be a group of people standing around, and somebody, usually several people, are filming what is happening. Recently, this happened up in New York to an older man who was accosted by several young people, some of them were females, and just beat him to near death. And nothing was done. So it's the same thing where people just stand around and either film it, but they don't want to get involved. And then there's a sort of psychological aspect to it. It's called the diffusion of responsibility. And I thought, if this can happen, and it does happen, it happens regularly in society with regard to physical attacks and things of that nature, and people not get involved. What about religious people when things come up and we just choose maybe to be silent and not say anything because we know the alternative is trouble. The alternative is controversy, maybe even division. And it keeps people from doing what they ought to do. And we think about these cases. I know my reaction when I see these attacks like this, I think in terms of safety and strength in numbers. I'm like, Why doesn't the entire group get involved to protect this people who's being attacked? Several people are typically better equipped than just one to be able to take on an attacker. You might say, well, they might have a gun. It's always possible. It's always possible, but the alternative is to watch someone potentially die or be maimed for life. And so what is it going on? And I want us to study this because actually the Bible talks about some examples of this, and they're helpful. So the other phrase is the phrase diffusion of responsibility. That's the other way to describe it. In other words, when no one acts, when one person doesn't act, the other people feel they're justified in not acting. And it basically is a matter of attribution. We just attribute to ourselves what we see in others doing or not doing. And it makes for a dangerous situation when you get into physical situations. One example of this, you see, it's somewhat similar to it, is over in Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10 in verse 30, we read the story of the Good Samaritan. And notice how people reacted to this man who had been attacked by thieves, who had been beaten, stripped of his clothing, wounded, and left half dead. That's his situation. He cannot help himself, and it's obvious that he's been attacked and cannot help himself. This is not a trap. This is something where someone needed to help this man. His need was obvious. I know sometimes we try to be careful because who knows what might be. It might be a trap. People may be hiding, and they're going to jump out when we try to help this person. People have to factor in all of these possibilities. It could have been the case here. It didn't matter to the Good Samaritan, but it mattered to some. It mattered to some. For example, a certain priest in verse 31 came down that road. When he saw him, he passed by on the other side. It reminds us of some of these cell phone videos that we see of people just doing nothing, just either passing on. And you see some of it like that too, where they're not standing around, they'll just keep walking, and you'll see them looking as they walk by, but they keep walking and won't get involved in it. So here is the priest. But then verse 32, likewise, a Levite, when he arrived at the place, says, came and looked and passed by on the other side. So he reacted the way the priest did. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was. When he saw him, he had compassion on him. Obviously, compassion is lacking in these cases of assaults where people just stand around and watch it take place. There's a lack of compassion for the innocent victim in these cases. The Samaritan is commended to us as one who loved his neighbor, verse 36, because he chose to get involved. He got involved because of his compassion. He went to him, bandaged his wounds, verse 34, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own animal, brought him to the inn, and took care of him. This is interesting. He followed up with care at the inn, but then, for whatever reason, business or otherwise, he had to go on. But it says he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, take care of him, and whatever more you spend when I come again, I will repay you. So which of these 3 do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? And they answered properly, the one who showed mercy. And Jesus said, go and do likewise. So it's a matter of getting involved in this situation to help, regardless of potential consequences. This mentality keeps people from doing things they might need to do. What about serving as a deacon in a local church? We might prefer to be the bystander and have that sort of as a psychology. Or to keep one from teaching a Bible class, to keep one from getting involved in helping out with building maintenance and care and doing things like that. What about preparing the Lord's Supper? There are always things that can be done. And the bystander mentality can be very dangerous. So we just expect that someone else will do it. That's that diffusion of responsibility problem. Well, someone else will do it. Someone else will take care of that. And then no one takes care of it. Someone else will get involved in that attack and help that poor victim who's being beaten to death. Surely someone else will do it, but then no one does it. And we justify ourselves in that. So we have to be careful. I said the Bible contains examples of this. One is back in the little book of Obadiah, which is talking about the Chaldeans invading Judea and attacking Jerusalem and slaughtering the people of God. Now, this was God's punishment, but what about the responsibility of the neighbors to help the Jews? They didn't know that this was God's plan as a punishment. What would be their responsibility in this? Edom, or Esau, the house of Esau, was condemned for just watching. We're told in Obadiah chapter 10, Obadiah verses 10 and 11, because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. Now I want you to think about this. There is no nation of Edom anymore. There's no house of Edom. You can't go and find that. I think I'll move to Edom in retirement. Nope. What happened to them? They were one of the nations that was judged by God, condemned by God, and this one would cease to exist. Because why? Well, he said, on the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You did not help your brother. You know, if you go back far enough, that was true in a physical, familial sense of Jacob and Esau. And so then you have nations represented by Jacob, the house of Israel, and then also the house of Edom. But Edom did not help when the Chaldeans attacked. And Obadiah is foreseeing this and prophesying about it and condemning them. The interesting thing is that by standing aloof, by being a mere bystander in this, they were accused of being like the attackers. I think that's how I would feel. I would not be able just to stand by someone's being attacked. Well, you might get hurt. That's very possible, especially when you're old, you know, gray-headed guy. But I don't know if I could live with myself. I had this discussion with a friend of mine back some couple of years ago. I was working on his house, and we had this discussion, and we actually had a disagreement on this. He said, you know, the best thing to do is just stay out of that stuff. I said, I can't do it. I couldn't do that. I'd feel guilty for the rest of my life. And, of course, my influences are the scriptures. There's one of them right here that's very helpful, showing that this bystander mentality is condemned by God. You were like one of... That's how God viewed this. By the house of Edom not getting involved in defending their brother Jacob, the house of Jacob, he said, you just were like a co-participant in that. You're just like one of the Chaldeans. One of those axe-carrying Chaldeans that came in here to slaughter and destroy. You're just like one of them. Another example of this over in the Judges. You know the great story of Deborah and Barak back in chapter 4. And they were going up against these Canaanites, led by Jabin, king, and Sisera would be the name that most of us would remember there because of Jael and the tent peg story. Notable story there of how he thought he could go to the house of Heber, the Canaanite, and Jael, his wife, said, come on in. Come on into the house. But she knew that God's vengeance was out against Sisera, and so she helped him. He fell asleep, and she took a hammer, a mallet, and a tent peg and drove it through his head and drove his head into the ground with a tent peg. It's kind of gruesome. But she was highly praised in Deborah's song for this in Judges chapter 5 and verse 25. But there was another group who did not get involved. They were bystanders. The little village of Miraz. Little village of Miraz. Verse 23 of Judges 5 says, curse Miraz, says the angel of the Lord. Curse its inhabitants thoroughly because they did not come to the help of the Lord, that is his army led by Barak and Deborah the judge, to the help of the Lord against the mighty, that is against the Canaanites. What did they do wrong here? Here's a small town, a village about 12 miles from Samaria. Distance shouldn't have been an issue. People came from much farther away, as are described in the song there, the helpers that traveled from much further than 12 miles to help out in this battle. And so, you know, no excuse there. But the idea is that what they did was hang back. They just stayed back. They just chose not to be involved. They were just bystanders. Might they have argued what a lot of people do today, that, well, God's in control of this. You know, even in the Old Testament, God, I always tell people, yes, God is in control. Now, how does that control work? Does it exclude human action and human free agency? Or does it include it? How is God in control? I think a lot of people forget free agency, they forget personal responsibility, and they're just like, I'll stay. It's like people voting. That Christians who claim, well, God is in control. There's no point in voting. What good does voting do? God allows us to vote. God allows us to pick our leaders. Romans 13 obligates us to pick leaders that fit with, that fit into the divine paradigm of what government ought to be. Otherwise, what's going to happen? We will have godless leaders who do godless things, who are constantly wasting billions of dollars. Have you ever seen that before? And then we have to work harder in order to pay for this lost money, for this abuse of funds. That's how that works. So no, God is in control, but he allows us to operate by our free agency. These people were condemned because they chose to not act. They chose to not get involved. There's a lesson for us there. Numbers 25 tells the story of the time when the Israelites were camped over at Shittim, after the because of the shittim wood there, or acacia wood, it's also called, that grew there. They're in the plains of Moab, and what happened was they were now participating in the idolatry and attendant idolatrous practices of the Moabites, Midianites, which included sexual immorality. You know, we were talking about the head covering this morning in class in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and there's a background to that too because of that huge temple there that was basically a prostitution was practiced as religion. You would honor the goddess of fertility, Aphrodite, by practicing sex. And the Corinthians grew up in that culture. And so I think some of the head covering points relate to that background there. But anyway, these people got caught up in this immorality, sexual immorality. The Jewish leaders were involved in this. The what were called chiefs of the heads of the family, or the heads of the families, tribal captains, people like that. God told Moses and the people to, the Hebrew word actually means, it says hang them, actually means to impale. To impale them, it says, in the sun before the Lord. In other words, make a public spectacle of them so that the people can see just how bad they are. To see how wrong they are, how corrupt they are, and having participated in the sacrifices to the dead, one of the Canaanite deity sacrifices, and also to engage in sexual immorality with these women. So impale them outside where people can see them. But it seems as you read on in there that one of them, one of the chiefs, a man named Zimri, a chief of the tribe of Simeon, a Simeonite, was involved in this. It seems like maybe he was still outside of the Israeli camp because it says here he came in. Otherwise, he would have already been dead, is my point. But he came in with this woman who was also kind of a popular gal because who her father was in the Midianite camp. Brings her right in. It says they came in and walked right before Moses and the others who were sitting there weeping over this atrocity. Just walked right in front of them. Now the order had already been given for these chiefs to be impaled. So this guy, he kind of missed out on that. He goes into the tent with this woman. You remember that Phineas becomes a notable name here. This context continues on down through about verse 15 or 16 of Numbers 25 because of him being so highly commended for what he did. He took a spear into the tent, stabbed both of them, the man and the woman, with one blow and killed them. And it says, stopped the plague, which is interesting because was he the last of these chiefs that needed to be killed? And why did the plague stop after just his killing? I don't know. But it has something, it may be explained in subsequent verses, where God said of Phinehas, I will make a perpetual priesthood of him. He was the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. He said, I will make a perpetual priesthood of him because he was zealous to defend my honor among them. Now picture this. This captain, Zimri, walks in with this woman, Cosby, right before Moses and the others here. These other fellows had already been executed. And he just boldly appears, just marches right on in, takes his new girlfriend with him, intends to engage in sexual relations. In fact, most people believe that the pair, were killed at the time they were engaging in sexual relations. He killed them both with one blow. Why was it then that the plague stopped that had killed 24,000 people? Just at that moment. Well, because a man got involved. He knew the law that had been given, that these chiefs were to be executed. Why was he allowed just to walk right through the gates of the camp, right on into his own tent, and engage in sexual relations with this woman? Why was that? Phinehas did something about it. He actually facilitated in the carrying out of God's orders to kill these chiefs. killed him. The plague stops, and all of a sudden Phinehas becomes praised in a rather spectacular way. It wasn't merely because, you know, I have a sermon on the New Testament reasons why Jesus complimented and commended people. You see this in other places in the Bible. Like Matthew chapter 8, the centurion, you know, I've not found so great a faith, no, not in Israel. And that was in a Roman centurion in Matthew chapter 8. Other instances of that. But this one is unique because God said he was zealous to defend my honor. So he's not just acting on orders. He's not just killing off the last chief here that had managed to evade and avoid execution. He said he acted because he was concerned about my, you know, some Bibles say jealous for my jealousy or zealous for my zeal. But I like the translation of zealous for my honor. That's the idea there in the passage. He's commended because he was not a bystander. You know, if you move into the New Testament, there are examples of this. What were the Corinthians? How were they behaving in 1 Corinthians chapter 5? Did they act on faith? Did they get involved when a notable sin is being committed? A sin that was not so much as named among the Gentiles that one should have his father's wife. Even the Gentile community looked down upon this, and they were rather open-minded about sin. But even they didn't like it when someone started having conjugal relations with his mother, or at least stepmother, father's wife. So how did the Corinthians react to it? It's okay. You ever wonder what the Corinthians were thinking? Were they doing what a lot of people do today when it comes to cases of church discipline, which is what this is, 1 Corinthians 5, and say, we don't need to get involved in that. You know, God's going to judge that anyway. God's already judged that. And then we avoid our personal responsibility. It's the bystander. When a whole church does this, it's the bystander syndrome. Whole churches do this. They just say, we decided it's not. They'll use human reasoning like, we've tried this before and it doesn't work. We discipline someone back in, and it's always funny to me because it'd be like in 1970 or something. We tried it back in 1953, and it didn't work. The person wasn't converted. They weren't restored. So we tried that, and it didn't work. We just need to let God judge. I don't know, whatever reason, whatever arguments people make, maybe they don't want the controversy. They don't want a reputation as a church that does this type of thing. They don't want to have to deal with family members in the church. Often there are family members. Usually the person who ends up being disciplined is a family member of someone. Well, if we take this action, even though this brother's family is in another church, that church will now look down upon us and they might not attend our gospel meetings. It'll be devastating. So we can't do this. And then they end up being mere bystanders. And God said, here's the problem with that, through Paul. Verse 6, here's the problem with not taking the action to shame, to have no fellowship or company with such a one, no, not to eat. Here's the problem with not doing that. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens or works through the whole batch of dough? Any cook, baker, knows that. That's how that works. It's a chemical spread, a chemical reaction, or a biological one, bacterial one, two different types of leaven, mechanical either way. And what does it do? It works through the whole batch of dough. What is he saying here? What he's saying is, if you don't take action and you're a mere bystander in this, or bystanders, you become complicit in the sin. God will judge you as being a fornicator if you don't take stand against the fornication that's being committed by a member of your church. That's pretty powerful. I know the Bible didn't read that way, but that's the meaning in verse 6. There's another passage that makes a point very similar to this over in 2 John. 2 John in verse 9. Now this time we're not dealing with moral issues. By the way, this is for brethren out there throughout the country, throughout the world, who for some whatever reason have decided that, yes, you know, we need to take a certain stand when it comes to moral issues like homosexuality or abortion or adultery. But doctrinal stuff can be tricky. People disagree over doctrine. Maybe God allows us a little bit of latitude when it comes to that. And then people just become bystanders when error is taught. Now, let me just tell you, I have lived this life where I have complained about some of my own preaching brethren. I'm saying, I'll tell my friends who are taking a stand, where is Brother so-and-so on this? Where are his talents, his speaking ability way better than mine, his communication skills, his knowledge of the Bible? Where are they right now? We need him. Sadly, it's not just him. It's dozens and dozens of others who have chosen to stay out of the fray, stay out of the controversy. They're just bystanding. They're just watching. They don't want to get involved. We know why. I was just talking to Josh Combs last night. I remember back when I used to hold several meetings a year. Even had to talk to Ron and Richard Sweets and Henry Honecker about, feel free if you want to, because I had several meetings coming up a couple of years in a row, and I said I don't like being gone that much. I don't think preachers ought to do that, who are hired by a local church. And I said, I feel like there's some reasonable amount. Whatever you guys think, just feel free to set that if that's what you want to do. You are the elders. We had that discussion. Then several issues came up. The Florida College Day of Creation controversy came up. The controversy over whether or not businesses have the right to hold gospel meetings. And things like that. And every time an issue, the deity of Christ issue, I lost a lot of friends on that. And every time a new issue would come up, I would have fewer meetings scheduled. Wonder if there was a connection between the two. And I don't really care. It's not like I have hard feelings about it. I hate that doors of opportunity are closed. But as far as the old thing of holding a gospel meeting, I don't see that as some great thing. I see the opportunity to preach the gospel as some great thing. How many meetings I hold a year is irrelevant. The opportunity to teach is the point. But anyway, you know what I'm saying. Some of these bystander preachers know full well that if you get involved in these controversies, you start having, H-A-L-V-I-N-G, every time one comes up, there's going to be a set of brethren here and a set of brethren there. On these issues, you start reducing your opportunities for holding gospel meetings. Your popularity decreases. You go from being a brotherhood preacher to being a nobody. And some people just don't want that. So doctrine matters. Notice what John said about this in 2 John verse 9. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ has not God. By the way, the word transgress here is a real good translation of that is the word progressive. Whoever becomes a progressive. How is progressive used in a bad sense? Well, any time and every time one progresses beyond the Scriptures. We're making great progress here, you know, at the church at such and such, Church of Christ here, there, or wherever. We're making great progress. Many of them have progressed so far that they've left the pattern of the New Testament for the work, worship, and organization of the church. That's great progress, isn't it? Or we've progressed. We just don't believe that doctrine matters. Does it? John said in 2 John verse 9 that if we do not abide in the doctrine of Christ, we do not have, that is, have fellowship with, the Father or the Son. And look at verse 10. He said, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house nor greet him. Wait a minute. Why can't I just be a bystander in this? I'm not the one teaching the false doctrine, or I'm not the one refusing to teach the whole truth. Why would this be my fault? I'm going to stay out of this. Bystander syndrome. Would God hold me responsible if I take that position? Well, this guy's coming through. I've known him for years. Yeah, he's off on divorce and remarriage, but he needs a place to stay tonight, and he needs some supper. I just feel like I better go ahead and have him at the house. Welcome him. Come stay with us. John explicitly forbids that action. Well, at least I need to wish him well. I need to greet him, you know, King James, New King James. At least I need to wish him well on his trip. If I can't, you know, give him a food and housing because of this verse, maybe at least I need to say, well, you know, I hope everything goes well for you. Nope, not even that. John said, you can't do that either. Because if you do that, verse 11, whoever greets him wishes him well. Isn't it interesting that verse 11 did not say, whoever provides food, shelter, clothing, whatever for him, but rather it said, he who greets him, he who wishes him well, shares in his evil deeds. Doctrinal error is evil. John called it evil, and by refusing to take a certain stand against it, I become a participant in it. The Bible is very clear about this. There's a verse over in Jeremiah chapter 48 and verse 10. We studied some related passages recently in our class in Ephesians 6. Yeah, I almost mentioned this verse the other night, and it went in my mind and slipped right through it. But in Jeremiah chapter 48 and verse 10, cursed is he who does not, who does the work of the Lord with slackness, and cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed. We realize the context here was physical, had to do with physical combat. But there's a spiritual application of it because of Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 17. Taking the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. We need to think about the responsibility we have to not be silent. I asked Josh to read that passage in Galatians chapter 2 in the first few verses of that chapter because of how it applies here. What did Paul do? Could Paul have chosen to have just been a bystander in that manner of the Judaizers and prominent brethren coming down from Judea and later with Peter and eating with the Gentiles, but when the prominent fellows came from Judea, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. Verses 11 through 14, Galatians 2. Paul could have, not acceptably, but as far as his power or ability, acted like Peter. Had he done that, he would have been as wrong as Peter was in that situation. Now, what did Paul say? What did Josh read? Paul said, to whom we gave place by subjection? No, not for an hour. Why? Why did you not give place? Well, that the truth of the gospel might continue with you. That needs to be our objective. That needs to be our purpose. The truth of the gospel. And sometimes the sword of the Spirit, has to be picked up and applied. It has to be used. Because failure or refusal to speak out can amount to God judging us as being a participant in the wrong. Now, I'm not saying, and I've been in situations where I have corrected people, advised people, guided them with scripture, say, now, you ought not do this or you ought to do the other. And then, because of the nature of our associations, it may be in the workplace or something like that. And they continue to behave that way. There's nothing in the Bible that suggests that you just keep on, you know, every day doing the same thing. But we do have a responsibility to do what we can. It's not like we have to live our lives every day going to work and correcting the foul-mouthed person. But have we said something sometime or another when we've had the opportunity to do so? I was just telling someone this week about my brother in the police department back home and how the police officers, they get into this, well, just the F word thing, just constant. And then when they have confrontations with criminals or people maybe they pulled over, it's just constant. And he said he's watched this, that when they get into using that type of foul language, that it escalates the tension. It becomes then a sort of a competition to see who can out-curse the other person. And the police officers get caught up in doing this. And I have, in my experience, I've noticed that some police officers have some of the most foul mouths of anybody that I know. So they can really learn that and think that it's intimidating and powerful to use it. Derek, you're smiling. I bet you've seen this before. They think that it's like a tool to give them power over others or to be able to show their smartness over others, their wit over others. Brian made his people put a dollar into a jar every time they slipped up and used that word. He said, we fill that jar up, we use that for good things, but he said, it's amazing what a habit that has become. How many dollar bills he's collected over the years from fanning them from using that language. Things like that. We just speak up and say something when we can. And especially when there's doctrinal error impacting brethren or moral errors, moral sins, we need to be ready to do what we can. Maybe there's someone here this morning who is not a Christian. Is it possible that you're doing this, that you're just standing by and, you know, just sort of watching, just sort of waiting? Why not get involved in the fight? Get involved in the fight that is the Lord's. Fight against sin and against error. But the important thing, of course, is it's a matter of getting involved, of getting into the church, is meeting the conditions of salvation that will save our souls. That's the important thing to consider. If you need to do that today, come forward as we stand and sing to encourage you.
What can wash away my